So announcements, just as a reminder, I was out yesterday. There's additional office hours right after class today, as well as the normal office hours, 12:30 to 1:30. Okay, so where are we? We started with this example application, ran a simulation of this 12 to 48 volt converter in order to figure out if our 97.6% efficiency prediction was correct. We found that it was not. We had way more loss than expected. We dug into the waveforms. We saw during the switching transition where the MOSFET turns on, there was this huge spike, 400-ish amps of current through the MOSFET and the diode going in this direction where it's kind of reversed through the diode and down through the MOSFET, involving the output capacitor in that loop. So we wanted to see what was the cause of this. We talked about kind of the high-level semiconductor physics going on in a power diode. Eventually found that there's going to be this phenomena called reverse recovery, where because of all the stored minority charge that helps this diode to conduct with the low incremental resistance, I'm going to have to pull out all of this charge in order to shut the diode off. If I have this diode operating in a circuit like a switching converter, where I am trying to very rapidly turn this off, I can't afford to just shut off the current to it and wait for a while before it becomes reverse biased for all these charges to slowly recombine according to the minority carrier lifetime. What's going to happen is when I try to turn on the MOSFET, effectively have a short here with the output capacitor, I'm going to pull a big spike of negative current, and I'm going to sustain that negative current until I've removed all of that charge, at which point the diode shuts off. Okay. So we developed an approximation for this loss. The approximation neglected kind of the slew rate that the current is taken over by the MOSFET. So this section here is the current commutating. It's all going through the diode. And then between this peak and zero is when that current shifts over to the MOSFET, my IL. So the MOSFET taking over IL. We're just going to neglect that, assume that happens instantaneously. And then this is all extra current beyond what I would normally need that removes that minority charge, QA, which is my minority charge. And then this is all charged to bring up the voltage on the depletion region capacitance. We also neglected that. And that gave us some nicer waveforms where we can just write an analytical expression for how much energy is lost in this reverse recovery process. And recall, where is that energy? It's all lost in the MOSFET. The diode is the one causing the problem, but the MOSFET is the one that's going to heat up because of it. Power losses occur here. Okay. And then we did this example similar to what I'm asking you to do on your homework, just to give you some insight as to how to include this switching loss mechanism or really any other switching loss mechanism in your average model. So we just sketched waveforms, including whatever spikes of current we get because of our switching loss, whatever non-idealities we get because of the switching loss mechanism. In this case, I sketched them this way. I did this to keep the volt-second balance valid, but one amendment I'll make to what I said last time, I said I want to sketch this TRR kind of back from my original edge. Even if I didn't do that, TRR should be much less than any DTS, D prime TS, any appreciable portion of my switching period. So even if I sketch it the other way, when I go through to do my volt second balance, I might think, okay, well, this time is now D prime TS plus TRR. The TRR is maybe 4 nanoseconds and DTS is 5 microseconds. So DTS plus TRR is just DTS. So even if you sketch it on the wrong side, any kind of DTS plus TRR is DTS because this time should be very fast with respect to any of my switching periods. If it's not, I've got a poorly designed converter. Instead of having a DTS period, I'm just going to have this reverse recovery. My operation is going to fall apart. So that's a fair approximation to make. And any of the converters will look at any sort of switching non-idealities occupy a very small portion of the switching period. Make sense? All right, so we got to this average model in the buck converter because the path for this reverse recovery current through the MOSFET and reverse through the diode went through the input source. I see reverse recovery charge showing up at the input of my converter. This charge is taken from the input source, shunted away, and result in additional power loss. Okay. I wanted to have one more slide on this. This is just showing practically from this model we developed, what is the efficiency versus duty cycle. So to compute that, I need some numbers. Plug in a switching frequency of 100 kilohertz, input voltage 24 volts, QRR, TRR times, and a load resistance. Here, my QR and TR are just constant values. And I talked about last time with these data sheet plots, these things actually vary with current level, also with temperature and slew rate. I'm just plugging in as constant values. What you see is that the efficiency degrades significantly, particularly right here. And there's an important reason for that. So I'm plotting versus duty cycle. This is a buck converter. I could also say this looks like my voltage going from zero to DG, or my power going from zero to VG squared over R. So my duty cycle goes to one, it's just a short through, and my input voltage is my output. It goes to zero, I have zero output voltage. I have load resistance at zero output voltage, I have zero power, and VG output voltage, I have VG squared over R. Okay. So my efficiency really tanks down here. Out here, there's some loss, but not so significant. It doesn't drop all the way to zero. And the reason for this is efficiency is output power over input power. If I have zero output power and I have anything coming in to supply losses, I'm going to get 0% efficiency. Okay? So I haven't seen this previously with our conduction loss only models, because if I'm only modeling conduction loss, when the power goes to zero, the current goes to zero, and the losses go to zero, and then there's kind of a limit taken as the terms of what your efficiency at zero is going to be. And if your power goes as I times V and your losses go as I squared V, or go faster, you'll be able to get a high efficiency predicted. In any real converter, your efficiency always goes to zero at zero power, because you always have some constant losses, something that doesn't depend on the current. Traditionally, the biggest of those, in most cases, is going to be switching type losses. They arise solely from the switching of the devices. And they may, like diode reverse recovery, it changes a little bit with the current level, but it has mostly to do with just you have to be switching the devices to keep it running. And those losses are going to be significant even at zero power. Okay. So down here, I'm getting into where I just have a watt or less of power and some remaining switching loss that causes my efficiency to tank. Out here, I have tens of watts of power, still have some, maybe a watt of switching loss, but it's less significant relative to the output power out here. Okay. So generally speaking, in any converter, we normally look at efficiency plots, see in literature and data sheets as output power versus efficiency. And the exact details of what this curve looks like depends on the design and the operation, but it's always going to have some shape that looks like this, where down here at low power for any real converter, my switching losses and potentially any control losses, just to have my gate drivers running and have my controller running, take over, and I have zero output power with some losses to keep it running. Then up here, I have enough output power to kind of drown out the effect of those switching losses, but now I'm conduction loss dominated as my I squared term begins to explode. Okay. We've always have this shape. We're dominated by switching losses down here, and then conduction losses. If I go higher. This is a comment I made a couple lectures ago. Just wanted to put up a slide from the book to discuss it. Paralleling diodes, when they are traditional PN diodes, will not work well unless special considerations are taken. And that's because of this conductivity modulation, the minority carrier nature of diodes. So as diodes heat up, I have more minority carriers, which is going to make it a better conductor. So if I parallel two of these diodes, then I'm hoping I1 is equal to I2 is equal to I over 2. This is I1, I2, and I coming in for diodes V1 and V2. So I hope that they're going to just share the current evenly, right? The current coming in is going to split between the two of them. For some reason, because of noise or thermal agitation or somebody bumping into my circuit, I get I1 a little greater than I2, or just some disturbance. If the current's greater, this thing's going to heat up a little bit more due to its internal losses. So I1 gets hot. That causes I1 minority carriers increase, which causes I1 conductivity to go up, which causes I1 to go up. It's going to then, because it's more conductive than D2, it's going to take more of the current, and now I've got kind of a cyclical thing here. Or it had more current, so it takes more current. We've got a positive feedback type setup. Okay. This will run away. It'll run away to a limited extent. These are still both going to have between zero and infinite impedance, so it's never going to be I1 takes 100% of the current and I2 takes zero, but it might split 80-20, 90-10. It will both take some, but you can't rely on it splitting evenly. This can still be done if you take care and are willing to deal with some mismatch in the currents. If you're relying on it being perfectly even, it's probably not going to work out. But if you rate these so that it'll still work at 60-40 and that's still advantageous, then maybe it's okay. Other things you can do is share a common heat sink between them. If they're on the same thermally conductive material, then as this one heats up, some of that heat will transfer over and heat the other diode up and can limit the thermal mismatch between the two to limit the current mismatch. Selecting matched devices so they have the same response to some change in temperature, same heat sink as the second bullet. External circuitry to try to balance the current, generally a losing battle. If you're trying to insert some current sensor in series with this, you're increasing the impedance of this line enough that you're probably killing the benefit of having two diodes in parallel anyway. And in rare cases, you might go that route. Okay. So there are different types of diodes. We've really focused on talking about PN diodes. It'd be these two. If you go out and search and try to buy a diode, they'll be labeled as standard recovery or fast or ultra fast recovery. Standard recovery are diodes where they haven't really made any effort to deal with this reverse recovery problem. And they're typically used as line frequency diodes. That's because recall that the power loss due to reverse recovery looked like some energy that we solved times the switching frequency. So if I'm switching them at line frequency, that FS term is very small versus 100 kilohertz or 1 megahertz switching frequency in a DC to DC converter. So I can deal with a big reverse recovery energy because it only happens 50 times, 60 times a second. If I'm trying to switch this thing at 100 kilohertz, I need that energy to be down so it doesn't explode into a large power loss. And then I would go to fast, ultra fast. They now have hyper fast. So these are all marketing terms. It just means that the manufacturers of these diodes have put some thought into reducing the reverse recovery and designed it to try to get that down. These ones will specify in the data sheet some characteristics of reverse recovery. Sometimes you don't get the parameters you really want. You might have QRR, but not at the current you want to run. But you'll at least have some information on the reverse recovery characteristics of it to design off of. Okay, so those are PN diodes. There's also this thing called a Schottky diode. A Schottky diode is fundamentally different in that instead of a PN junction between P-doped and N-doped semiconductor, it's a metal-to-semiconductor junction. So a Schottky diode would look like my anode of some metal. And then it goes straight to N minus N region cathode with no P-type material in here. This metal to semiconductor junction can be designed to still have a diode-like behavior of a barrier voltage built in, done by selecting the doping level of this region and selecting the type of metal used here so that there is some work function to get between the two materials, which will give me a unidirectional junction for charge flow. This is now a majority carrier device. So because there's no P-type region, I am going to conduct with electrons in the N-type material, and I have no holes being injected into this. Well, the problem with that is I get no conductivity modulation, right? And the same sort of design constraints apply to this. If I want it to block high voltage, I need a long, lightly doped N minus region, which is going to be high resistance. That's why, at least at the time this book was written, they were limited to relatively low voltage. If I want to block more than about 100 volts, I need this region to be so long and so lightly doped that I might have tens of ohms of resistance in this device, in addition to the barrier voltage, to make it useless for most applications. So that's a bad thing. No conductivity modulation. The good thing is there is essentially no reverse recovery. So when I want to shut this thing off, there is no stored minority charge that I have to remove. I can almost instantaneously shut this thing off, eliminating all those reverse recovery losses. Okay. So this thing really just looks like a diode in parallel with a capacitance. Still, when I shut it off, I'll have a depletion region to block that voltage, extending down in the N minus region. That'll give me some capacitance, but no reverse recovery in these things. Restricted to 100 volts or more, I said, as of the time the book was written. It's because since then, we've been able to get higher by going to different materials. So in silicon, I'm going to be limited to around this range. In the last 10 years or so, we've seen a big surge in power devices made from, or known as wide bandgap materials, like silicon carbide, gallium nitride. In particular, silicon carbide, just because of better material characteristics that allow it to have a higher electric field in this region, I can make that shorter and more heavily doped and still block the voltage I need to block. Now we have, using wide bandgap materials, in particular silicon carbide instead of traditional silicon, now we can have 1200 volt plus Schottky diodes. So, doing much better. On all this stuff, I want to make a note here. If you guys are interested in this type of thing, go to potential www.eecs.utk.edu. And potential, spelled with two N's. The 10 in there is for Tennessee. This is a graduate traineeship program that we have here in the department. Funds graduate students to do research on power electronics using wide bandgap devices. The reason I pointed it out here is because there are a couple pages in the About section that give tutorials on semiconductor physics. I went over some of it kind of quickly here just to give you some intuition as to how these things work. You want to look at, okay, exactly what are the design constraints on the height of this region mean for my devices? What are the inherent limits on what I can create? Why is this true? It talks about that a little bit on that website. Okay. So feel free if you're interested. Potential. Okay. Solar Schottky diode seems like a great thing. The converter I've been working with is a 48 volt max converter. It's still under 100 volts, so I can take a silicon Schottky diode and plug it in here. And that's what I've done on this converter here. The symbol for a Schottky looks like a normal diode, except it's got these little arms. That means that it's a Schottky. And by putting a Schottky diode in there, what I see is my efficiency goes from 93.9 up to 96.9. I get a pretty significant decrease in losses. Now recall, my predicted, based on just my conduction loss model, was 97.6. So I still have some missing losses. Up to 96.9, 97.6, you might say, well, 0.7%, that's within the noise. 0.7% doesn't sound like a lot. The common mistake is to think of differences between efficiencies as percent. It's the difference between percent and percentage points, right? So 0.7 percentage points difference here may not sound like a lot, but it's effectively reducing the percent of my power that goes to loss from 3.1% to 2.4%, which is about a 30%, 20 to 30% decrease in my total losses, okay? It's an important thing to keep in mind. So 1% difference in efficiency. Well, if I'm talking about I went from 50% to 51%, then yeah, that's really nothing to write home about. But as I get to high efficiency, if I'm talking about going from 99% to 100%, well, that's just 1% difference. That means I need to eliminate all of my losses to make the thing perfect. As you get to high efficiency, every little bit increase in efficiency is very difficult. Okay. So, point being, there are still some significant additional losses that I didn't model in my original conduction loss model, even when I get rid of reverse recovery. So to figure out where those are, I'm going to dig into next the MOSFET. And I've got two in parallel. You may recall, I'm just going to look at one. Because as I go to the efficiency waveforms, what I see is that the spike is still here. Question mark, exclamation point. So thought we got rid of this by getting rid of reverse recovery, but I'm still seeing this spike at the time when the MOSFET turns on, shows up in both the MOSFET and the diode. If I zoom in again on that, what I see is that, hey, this spike still exists. It's got some different shape now, and it's significantly reduced in amplitude. Before, with reverse recovery, the spike was going up to 400 amps. Now it's going to 10 amps. Here, about 10 amps was 400 plus when I had reverse recovery. Okay. But I still have something going on at this switching transition. Is as my MOSFET turns on and brings the switch node voltage down, which is the drain to source voltage of the MOSFET. So I turn it on here, voltage across it is initially 48. As it drops down to zero, I'm seeing some spike of current goes through both the MOSFET in the blue trace and the diode in the red trace. Ideally, my waveform should look like some real quick transition and the diode current goes to zero. Some real quick transition and the MOSFET current goes to IL. This is my ideal waveforms, right? But I guess this spike beyond that. Okay. So where's this coming from? Now what I want to talk about is the operation of a power MOSFET. This is a cross section of a power MOSFET. First thing you might notice is that this looks different from signal level MOSFETs that you've seen before. Because this is a vertical conduction device, so my source and drain are on opposite sides of the die instead of both being on the top. That's because to get a MOSFET with a on resistance low enough to be useful in power type applications, I need a huge area. I have no hope of getting multiple of these on a single die. I'm not trying to create an amplifier with tens of transistors or some digital circuit with millions of transistors. I'm going to have just one transistor per die. And I'm going to make a vertical conduction pattern because it allows me to better utilize the silicon. I can have kind of straight vertical conduction instead of in a lateral device. I have to have this conduction that's kind of a hemisphere, which creates larger resistance when I get up to high voltage. So this structure is what's known as a BDMOS, which is a vertical diffusion MOSFET. Acronym not so important, but it is a vertical conduction device. Okay. So how does this work? This stuff, this kind of hatched region, is all metal. And then this gray stuff is an oxide, some insulator. And then white is all some sort of semiconductor, or in the case of the gate, probably a polysilicon, but conducting. So I'm going to look just at a slice of this thing here. So in this region, what I have is this well is my source. My drain is down here. And this P well is my body. Substrate contact for this. And you can see the metallization goes right over the source and the body, shorting them together. So I have inherently my body shorted to the source. And my gate comes over with some oxide in the middle. This region here is going to be the channel. So initially, I'm going to have no conduction from this N well down to this large N minus region. As I bring a voltage up on the gate, it's going to pull conductors in from the adjacent N region, create an inversion layer in this little section of P-type body that makes it conductive. Once I do that, I've got a conductive pathway that goes all the way from the source down to the drain. Okay. So once I turn this on, my conduction on it from drain to source, it's going to come up, go through the channel, and then go out the source. So this little unit here is kind of one MOSFET. And then it's going to be put in parallel with a bunch of other conduction pathways that are all directly in parallel to get my low on resistance that I want. I'm generally going to use kind of in my process a minimum gate and then throw a ton of these in parallel, which actually makes it a very long MOSFET. I'm going to build out in two dimensions. That's shown in this next slide. Is the same cross section, but just showing it kind of in a 3D slice. So I've got gates interspersed throughout, and I'm going to expand in this direction and in this direction, just repeating these little unit cells of MOSFET to build up something with low on resistance. So each of these little unit cells may be 100 ohms of resistance, and I parallel up 1,000 of them to get something that's 100 milliohms. Okay. So if I'm building out in these directions, this area should be, call it X and Y, is proportional to 1/(1) my on resistance. So the bigger the area, the more of these I put in parallel, the lower my on resistance gets. Make this thing a bigger die to get a lower on resistance. And then this region, this kind of tall N minus region, the taxial or sometimes called drift region. It's going to have kind of the same design purpose that we talked about with the N minus region in the diode. This is where I'm blocking my voltage. And if I want to block higher voltage, if I want this to be a 1,000-volt device, I need to make this region very tall and very lightly doped. That's going to increase my resistance because I now have a longer conduction pathway. And a MOSFET, like a Schottky diode, is a majority carrier device. No conductivity modulation. When I conduct, I create this inversion layer, and then it's electrons all the way through. So my resistance through this region is determined by how long it is and how heavily I dope it. I want to dope heavily to get the R on down. I need to dope light to get the breakdown voltage up. There's going to be some inherent trade-off there. Generally, higher voltage devices are going to be larger resistance, unavoidable. What else do we see here? So there are inherent diodes that are unavoidable here. Everywhere I see a PN junction, it's going to be here and then into each of these wells. These two diodes are going from the body to the source and from the body to the drain. So my MOSFET, sketch this out as a four-terminal device. It's going to look like this, where I have diodes from the body to the drain, from the body to the source. I have these two parasitic diodes that are always going to be there because of the structure. Then I metallize such that my source and my body are shorted together. So I've effectively shorted out this diode. What that leaves me with is my three-terminal schematic, where I have just one parasitic body diode that I care about. The other one's still there, but it's got a direct short, so it could never turn on, never do anything interesting. Okay, what else do I want to say about this? So when I turn this thing on, I'm going to turn it on by taking the gate to source up above the threshold, and if I'm using this as a power device, it's going to go much greater than the threshold to really get it fully on. Turn on, it's going to create a near short between drain and source, have nearly zero voltage drain to source. Then I'm going to be able to conduct current through this pathway from drain to source or source to drain. As I do so, I'm going to see some resistance, and that resistance is composed of the resistance through every material, every region I have to go through. I have to go through the source metal, that's going to give some resistance of the metal. I go down through semiconductor and through the channel, some channel resistance, through this drift region, then through the substrate, then out the drain metallization. And all these add up in series. This whole thing is going to be my R on is RS plus R channel plus everything else. Okay. Kind of rules of thumb, this drift region resistance is dominant in high voltage devices. And it's because, like I said, to get high voltage blocking capability, it's going to be long and lightly doped. So this is going to be far and away the largest resistance. In low voltage devices, 10 volt, 20 volt MOSFET, tends to be more the channel and somewhat the metallization that are larger. Just offhand, rough numbers for a 1200 volt device, 50 milliohms may be a pretty good low resistance MOSFET. For a 5 volt MOSFET, half a milliohm or less, pretty reasonable. It all just depends on how long the strip region has to be, how dominant it is. Eventually, this becomes small enough that I'm more dealing with channel resistance, metallization resistance. Okay, so operation of this thing when conducting, I want to make a couple comments just on these kind of general curves you've probably seen before. These are characteristics of any general MOSFET, looking at the gate to source voltage versus the drain current for curves of different drain to source voltage. If I look at this, the whole thing's in cutoff if gate to source is small. Somewhere for a power MOSFET around the 3 to 4 volt range, I'll hit the threshold and begin to turn on. As I turn on, I'm going to initially go into this active SAT region. If I want to use this as a switch mode device, what I want to do is get this gate to source voltage out here somewhere, not just slightly above threshold, but way out here. For a power FET. That's because based on my operation, I may say, okay, I need to conduct 2 amps of current when it turns on. And what I want to do is get to that 2 amps somewhere out here where I'll be on some other VDS curve. With some negligible value, right? Because when it's on and it's conducting current, I want drain to source voltage. That means I've got current times voltage. I've got power loss. Okay? If I try to conduct 2 amps somewhere near the threshold, I might have 2 amps. I might be on this 200 volt curve. I'll get 400 watts of power loss. More realistically, in any converter that doesn't have 200 volts available, it'd drop my current down. But point being that not really fully on, not very conductive, I'm going to have a lot of power loss. Another thing to note on this is that as I go higher and higher current, I'm eventually going to hit this boundary region between the ohmic mode and active SAT mode, where the device can't really stay in a nice low resistance operating mode. It's going to fall back into active SAT, hit saturation, and look more like a current source, and the voltage is going to keep increasing. So if I look at the data sheet of this device, it may tell me, okay, this is a 10 amp device, but at 10 amps, I may have a minimum of 2 volts drain to source voltage or 20 watts of instantaneous loss. Just never going to work in a reasonable power converter. So being when you select a MOSFET, looking through the data sheet, MOSFET's conduction capability should be assessed by the on resistance. So they'll tell you some maximum current. You might think this thing's a 10 amp device and I need to conduct 10 amps, so it meets the ratings. But you're going to have excessively high loss because this 10 amps comes from one of two things, either the maximum it can do before it hits saturation or a thermal limitation, which means this is the maximum before it burns itself up, which means it's got a lot of power loss already approaching that limit. So designing for your converter, you don't care what the current rating is, you care what the on resistance is and what the power losses of that are going to be. Is that acceptable for your design? Not shown here, but on this note, I want to make another comment. Breakdown voltage, or sometimes they'll label it as VDS max for the device, is the absolute maximum. Which is a little bit different than some other parts in other fields. So if I'm selecting an op amp and it says this is a 5-volt op amp, I can put a 5-volt supply on it and be happy. If I'm selecting a power MOSFET, it says this is a 50-volt power MOSFET, and I run it in my 48-volt converter, it's almost certainly going to blow up, because when it switches, there'll be some ringing, some additional transient on the voltage, and it'll go above 50, and it'll immediately blow up. You always need to select your maximum voltage blocking capability with some safety margin. 2x is usually conservative. For my 48-volt converter, I might be choosing 100-volt rated MOSFET. So this is when it's conducting. When I shut the MOSFET off, what I'm going to end up with is a picture that's pretty similar to what I looked at with the diode. From the cutoff region, drop my VGS voltage down to about zero, and then I've got some VDS applied to this thing. The drain's down here, and my source is upside down with the positive drain to source voltage that this is blocking. That's going to again be blocked by an electric field in a depletion region at this PN junction of the body diode. It's kind of the body diode that's blocking that. As the voltage increases, this depletion region is going to expand. Can expand very far into my N minus drift region and only a little bit into my heavily doped P-type body. This depletion region, just like we looked at in the PN diode, is completely devoid of carriers, an insulator. It's going to block voltage. And the behavior of my MOSFET when it's in this cutoff region is going to be that of a bunch of capacitances. I've got these three terminals of it still, gate, drain, and source. And I'm going to have various capacitances between all of them. From my gate, I'll have capacitances through the gate oxide to the metal of the source, and to the semiconductor of the source and body, which are both shorted together. I've got kind of these three capacitances from the gate out to the various regions of the device. And then I'll have these two capacitances from the drain to the source and from the gate to the drain, which cross over this depletion region. These capacitors from the gate to various points around here are all going to be generally linear capacitors. They just have to do with kind of how big is this gate, how thick is the oxide, it's going to look like just capacitance through this insulator. These two things, which go across this depletion region, are going to look pretty heavily nonlinear. What I mean by that is, as I block more voltage, the depletion region gets bigger, the capacitance drops. Okay. Look at that on a data sheet for an example MOSFET. So this is now my model of this MOSFET in the cutoff region, or when I'm modeling the behavior in the cutoff region. What I have is some ideal MOSFET here, or model the R-on resistance of this thing. And then external to that, I have the body diode and then these three caps due to these parasitic capacitances internally. Looking at this plot first, these are three capacitances on a measured device. Labels are kind of hard to read. This top one is what's called CISS. And that is gate to source capacitance plus gate to drain capacitance. Middle one is COSS, which is gate to drain capacitance plus drain to source capacitance. Last one is CRSS, and that's just the gate to drain capacitance. Okay. The reason they report them this way is because of how they measure them. For example, to measure the drain to source capacitance, What I would do is short the gate and source together and then measure from drain to source what the capacitance is. In doing so, if I short the gate and source together, I've effectively shorted this gate to drain and drain to source capacitor in parallel. They both connect to the drain. Once I short gate and source together, they're both directly in parallel. So the manufacturers just measure that and report it. These are pretty easy to back out. This is a log scale plot. And each of these differences, 10x between these divisions. So if this one is just gate to drain, and COSS is gate to drain plus drain to source, and it's almost 10 times bigger, means that drain to source is about 10 times bigger than gate to drain. So this is still approximately just equal to the drain to source. And then same thing with this top one, the ISS, it's got the gate to drain approximately equal to just the gate to source. I put a G instead of a C here. Okay. So we see the gate to source capacitance is relatively flat, more or less doesn't care what the drain to source voltage is. That's because it's just from the gate to these regions, it's not crossing the depletion region. The drain to source and gate to drain capacitances are heavily nonlinear because they cross this depletion region. The drain to source being a lot bigger, the gate to drain, because gate to drain has to go a longer distance through this kind of collection region. So as the voltage goes up, the capacitance drops. Working with nonlinear capacitances is not going to be a focus of this course. So whenever I ask you to work with this type of circuit, look at capacitive losses, I'm going to allow you to approximate them as linear. I'll give you the value I want you to use there. Working with nonlinear capacitances and more advanced switching loss, E-switch, the subject of ECE 581. Hot, hopefully next fall. So keep that in mind for next fall if you're interested in delving more into switching loss analysis and optimizing design of converters to eliminate switching losses. Okay. But for the time being, I've got these capacitances now. The other plot that's going to be important from a MOSFET datasheet is this Q gate, sometimes called QG, the gate charge, nanocoulombs versus the gate to source voltage. So this is telling me, as I supply current to this gate, how much charge is needed to raise the gate voltage up to a certain point. What I get is this kind of weird looking plot. If it was just a capacitance, Q is equal to CV, I'd expect this thing to just be a straight line with some slope that is the capacitance. But instead, I get this stair step thing, and if I look real close, the slope of this is a little bit different than the slope of that. And why does that happen? Well, when I turn this thing on, initially, what I'm doing is I'm supplying current, bringing this charge up, and most of that current is going into this gate to source capacitor. Because gate to source capacitor is so much bigger than the gate to drain capacitor. So most of it, my charge goes into the gate to source cap until I reach the threshold voltage somewhere here. As I reach the threshold voltage, this MOSFET begins to turn on. It was in a switching application initially blocking some large voltage. After I hit the threshold, it'll begin to turn on, but it'll still be a fairly high impedance. So it takes until I go a little bit above the threshold before this thing really gets going and starts to switch. Okay. When it really gets going and starts to switch, what's going to happen is my VDS in the converter we've been designing is going to go from 48 volts down to 0 volts, just for some example numbers. Right. And it's going to do so relatively quickly when my VGS is somewhere in the 4 volt range. as I go from 4 volts to 4.2 volts, this thing takes off and switches most of the voltage. I got a 48 volt swing over here. My gate to source is more or less constant, changing a little bit. So this happens very quickly. If I look at a loop through these three capacitors, that means is that this voltage, gate to drain, goes from 44 volts down to minus 4 volts. So this capacitance is much smaller than the gate source capacitance, but when I actually switch, I have a much bigger change in voltage on it. So this little plateau here is when I actually switch the voltage on the device, bring the drain to source down, and I'm going to have a bunch of charge going through this capacitance because of the change in voltage on it. Generally, this part of the curve is charge going into CGS. This part is charge going into CGD. Then up here, I'm again putting charge back into CGS. Now the device is switched, and I'm just bringing the gate to source voltage up higher to get the on resistance down. Okay. So this section is called the Miller Plateau. This is when VDS changes. And one last comment on this. I want to do this very quickly, right? So I want, again, this to be some negligible portion of my switching period. I want to go from off and quickly blast up, get this thing fully on. I don't want to spend a lot of time in here in the middle where I'm not fully on, not fully off. The voltage is slowly falling. So this is the reason why when we drive a MOSFET, we need to have some circuit known as a gate driver, which is essentially a buffer. But I may be deriving my signal here from some microcontroller that's able to supply 3.3 volts with up to 10 milliamps of current. That's going to tell me when to turn on and when to turn off, but I need something that can supply me maybe 2-3 amps of current at up to 15 volts. I can very rapidly switch, turn this thing on and off. I can't rely on the voltage levels or the current capability of any of my signal or digital electronics. So I use this gate driver. It's essentially just a buffer. The input goes high, the output goes high. The output could be 15 volts, input might be 3.3 volts from some microprocessor, and I need a milliamp here to turn this on, but I'm going to supply 10 amps here to rapidly turn this gate on. Okay. So I can supply all of this gate charge in a very short amount of time, quickly turn it on. Okay. Pick up there on Friday.